I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. A great bookstore makes the neighborhood special, and Mitchell Kaplan has been running one such bookstore for 25 years. It is Miami's Books and Books, and on the occasion of its anniversary, we staged a live discussion with Mitchell and the author of The Hometown Advantage, Stacy Mitchell. We'll hear that conversation today on Smart City. And we'll talk with Greg Robison about culinary tourism in Oregon. We'll travel to Books and Books today on Smart City right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Mitchell Kaplan owns Books and Books with four locations in South Florida. Mitchell is co-founder of Miami Book Fair International and serves as the chairperson of its board of directors. He recently served a two-year term as president of the American Booksellers Association and is on the board of the ABA's Foundation for Free Expression. Stacy Mitchell is a senior researcher with the New Rules Project, a program of the nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance. She has advised numerous communities on how to strengthen locally owned businesses.
I want to ask you, Mitchell, thinking back to, I guess, 1982, did I do the math right? Thinking back to 1982, what was your impulse to open a bookstore?
I think initially my impulse was to get as far away from law school as I could get. And I think that was one of the things. No, I think when I think back, for me, somewhere along the line, I had developed this feeling about writers as heroes, as my heroes. And I think maybe I flirted with the idea of writing. You know, I never really think I had the patience nor the talent. And as I became an English major and went through, you know, college, I really found at the center of a lot of literary movements throughout the 20th century, you found a bookstore. Shakespeare and Company in the 20s with Sylvia Beach. You had Francis Steloff's Gotham Book Mart in New York in the 30s and 40s. And then you had City Lights in the 50s, which kind of defined the Beat Generation. And this idea of bookstore as community center is really, I think, what got firmly stuck in my mind. And when I left, I'm from Miami, and I left and I came back, I think I wanted to sort of selfishly create an environment that I'd want to go to. And I think that was part of it as well.
I didn't hear anything about the profit motive. So where was the profit motive in that?
You know, that's a very good description of most independent bookstores. And maybe, you know, most successful small business people. I mean, what you have to do often is start with a passion when you have a small business. You have to, you know, something has to be there to drive you to work 60, 70, 80 hours a week. And the passion of creating space, of being able to surround myself in an environment that I want, I think trumped the profit motive. And fortunately, you know, profits did come as well, or I still wouldn't do this. And I think what I learned very early, maybe within about a week of having a bookstore, is I realized I better learn something about business or else I'm not going to be able to keep doing this. And so basically all the business that I've learned has been sort of on-the-job training. And some would say I maybe haven't learned it all that well, but I'm still here 25 years later. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about that, and I do think, you know, profit motive certainly is something which drives people, and so does passion for creating something in and of itself. And maybe the lesson there is you have to have passion about something, either to make a lot of money or to create some wonderful environment.
Stacy, you're an expert on independent retailers. Is Mitchell's story typical?
It's very typical. I've traveled around the country and met hundreds of independent retailers and talked with them in all different fields, toy store owners, pharmacists, and it's always very similar when you ask them about why do you do this, how did you get into this. They always talk about the passion that they have for what it is that they do, and the business aspect of it is something they learned how to do in order to be able to do what they really wanted to do.
Is that the special appeal of independent retailing, passion?
I think it's part of it. You know, it's from a customer standpoint, that's clearly an important part of it, because it translates into all of these returns to you as a customer in terms of the quality of the business. But there's so many other reasons as well. I think the connection to the community is so important. Mitch gave me a tour of the bookstore when we came in, and I think you knew 9 out of the 10 people that we passed who were browsing in here, we stopped and talked with. And that's, you know, it's a remarkable thing that's true of many independent retailers and is not the impersonal experience that we have in chains.
I want to ask you about that. Liz talked about your new place that's your new store that's opening in the Grand Cayman. You're not going to be able to know 9 out of 10 people when you walk through that store. I don't know how present you intend to be, but at what point do you become a chain or not local? Is it in the region?
That's an interesting question. The way that store is structured, actually, is that it's a joint venture that we're doing with local people in the Cayman Islands.
Well,
there aren't too many bookstores there, so this is a kind of a first for this area. But what we've done is we've hired all locally in the Cayman Islands. There's a whole Cayman Islands team. Some of them might be in the audience tonight. They're coming up here to kind of learn about bookselling. So it will, in a lot of ways, be local. Mm-hmm. Just like in the other stores in Miami that we have, I'm not there as much, and they've all created their own kind of environments within the community they are. And I think that is a bit of a difference between a small independent, quote, chain and a larger chain, in that what I've always tried to do is not standardize everything that we do. Each of the stores kind of fit the community that it's in. And I know there are probably downsides to that, you know, from the from not being standardized. But I think particularly with a bookstore where you're dealing with so many, you know, different titles and such a different kind of selection per store, that it needs to be tailored to the community that it's in. That's part of the problem, actually, with centralized chain bookstores, is that the buying is done mostly out of one centralized office. And so there's one buyer, one fiction buyer, for instance, buying fiction for the stores all across the country. Now, I'm sure they have a lot of computer printouts, and they can probably predict, but they're not going to have their ear to the ground as much as we do within our communities.
What are the responsibilities that you delegate to your managers in your other stores that allow them then to localize the store?
Well, one of the things that they can do is bring in any book that they want. They can bring in any title that they think they're able to sell, or anything that will fit, you know, and if you go into all the stores, they also are able to display whatever they want in any way that they want to. So you go into all the different stores and the displays are all different. And it's almost like there are 3 different stores that are branded, you know, as Books and Books stores.
Does that ever prove confusing to the customer?
I haven't heard that, really. The thing that happens sometimes is someone who might be at one store might not know that we have these other stores. But I haven't heard it being a confusing thing.
Stacy, we're using the term independent retailer. Define that in your terms.
I think an independent retailer is one that's owned locally by someone who lives in the community. And, you know, what the community is geographically is, you know, sometimes a question, but, you know, within what people would consider to be their community. And that they have full decision-making power over the business, which is an important distinction, I think, for many franchises where you have a local owner technically, but they don't actually have a lot of control over how the business operates. And so there really isn't that local decision-making that's happening.
Mitchell, if you think about the 25-year history of Books and Books, does that history break down into certain segments, natural segments for you, where there are markers?
Absolutely. I mean, when we opened in 1982, there were a lot of people like me opening bookshops, you know, exiles from English departments around the country. And you know, we decided to open up our stores. We never imagined that we would be caught in this gigantic play between these large, gigantic chains. For many of us, it was kind of stepping out a little bit into a more alternative kind of business lifestyle. So I think, and when we first opened, over 50% of all books sold were sold in stores like mine. In fact, there were probably, I would say, about 7,000 to 8,000 members of the American Bookseller Association.
How many?
7,000 to 8,000 members in 1982. There's probably now less than 1,700 members. So I think, you know, when I think of the shift, I think at one point, and I don't remember exactly when that was, but I was opening up the business pages to look at the stock prices of my competitors, and I knew the world had changed. When I was looking to see the health of a Barnes & Noble or the health of a Borders and seeing, you know, and reading that they were opening 400 stores up a year and a lot of my friends were being imperiled and they were going out of business, that happened in the late 80s, basically. And that became a huge, that really politicized a lot of booksellers to that point. You may remember, maybe you don't, but there was actually a lawsuit that the American Booksellers Association brought against publishers and then against chain stores in an attempt to level the playing field. There was a lot of dirty dealing going on in the bookselling business, just like there was in every other business. But we really took it upon ourselves to try to air that in some way with this attempt to level the playing field. Because I firmly believe, and I know so many wonderful booksellers, that if the playing field is level, a good independent store will trump a chain store any time. And we just need to have that same kind of level field, though.
We've lost so much of the social and civic fabric of the places that we live in this country. You know, what animates the street life, what brings people together. You know, there's such a difference. If the way that you run your errands is to go to a neighborhood business district or to go into a downtown where you're walking down a sidewalk and you're going into stores where you often know the owner, maybe your kids go to school with them, maybe you have some relationship through the community where you're running into your neighbors and having those sort of informal interactions that you have in line at the bakery or in the aisles of the local hardware store. Those are the kinds of spaces. Independent retailers are an important part of what supports the informal public life of our communities. And those kinds of places are increasingly rare in much of the country. For many people, the way that they run their errands is to get in their car, to drive, usually alone, and to arrive in a landscape that is really built not for people, but for cars. And if you hang out in the parking lot of one of these large retailers and you watch what people do, you don't see any of that meaningful loitering that goes on in a traditional business district. People make a beeline for the front door because a parking lot is about, you know, is a space that is least supportive of that kind of neighborly behavior. And then you're in a store that's typically sized to serve a much larger region than a neighborhood. That's part of the scale of the business. And what that means is the chances that the people that you're in line behind or your neighbors is fairly slim. It's a very different kind of shopping experience, and it doesn't surprise me that as we move more and more towards that, we have become more alienated from one another, and we've gotten more disengaged in our communities. We're belonging to neighborhood groups less, we're voting less, we're going to city council meetings less frequently. And I think that has something to do with this sort of hyper-individualized and isolated experience that we have.
Do you not think there's a happy medium that big boxes and chains can coexist with independence and you get the best of both worlds?
If there was, we've long passed it. I mean, I think that you just look at the statistics in all of these different retail sectors and the amount of development of chain retailers that has gone on. Here's a statistic that I just think is astounding. In the last 15 years, the amount of retail store space per capita in this country has doubled. We have just grown an enormous amount of retail far beyond the capacity of what we can support. And, the result of that is, as Mitch was talking about, is that you create this environment. The reason that there's been this overdevelopment is that for chains, they can finance that. They know that by creating this overcapacity in a marketplace, it's a lot easier to capsize your smaller competitors who have to pay their bills at the end of the month and have more difficulty operating in that kind of environment.
Can you talk about that formula a little bit and how the money flows and the comparisons between the two?
Sure. Well, if you were to visualize an economy that had lots of, a neighborhood or city that had lots of locally owned retailers, Those businesses tend to buy a fair number of goods and services from other local businesses. Studies show that if you spend a dollar at a locally owned store, anywhere from 54 to 68 cents of that dollar stays in the immediate area because the local store is hiring a local accountant, advertising in local media, often buying inventory from local producers or regional distributors, hiring a local web developer. They're doing all of this spending. So what you see is this web of interconnections. And a dollar that goes in one place creates this ripple of benefits through all of them and sustains a much larger number of jobs in the local economy. When you have a national retailer come in, if you have a big box store that comes in, those chains of connections are severed as the dollars start to shift into the big box store. Those studies show that, as little as 15 cents of every dollar spent at a typical sort of superstore stay in the local area because those retailers, they don't need the local accountants. They don't do as much local newspaper advertising because they advertise on television. So you begin to get this one-track economy. Instead of being a web, you've got a system where the money simply moves out. And it looks a whole lot like colonialism. I mean, it doesn't really look like something that supports this broad prosperity. It really looks like an extraction of wealth.
If that's true, why do you think local officials don't recognize it and act on it?
Well, I do think more local officials are starting to see what's at stake, and I think we're seeing a shift in that. But I think, traditionally there's just such a desperation on the part of local officials to create jobs and to create tax revenue. And these kinds of developments on their face seem to do both of those things. You have an empty piece of land that becomes a Home Depot. You've got 300 people employed there, and you've got new tax revenue coming in. How could you be? Obviously, that's expanded the economy. The problem is that there has not been a real careful look on the part of most cities at what the other side of the balance sheet shows, what the dollars that are lost at local stores, the jobs that are lost at local stores, as well as the very high public services cost. I mean, that's a much more inefficient pattern of development when you start to talk about having to provide roads and sewers and police and all that sort of thing.
Mitchell, I want to pick up on the public policy question with you, again, thinking both as the owner of this bookstore and having been president of the American Booksellers Association, what can public officials do to encourage independent, locally owned businesses?
I'm not exactly sure what local businesses can do. I mean, local government can do other than make sure that when they think of the kinds of subsidies they're giving to bring in, various projects, mm-hmm. they should be aware and concerned about what goes into those projects, not just the fact that the projects are being built. I think it has to be kind of a reimagining for local government to understand and appreciate what a local business does bring to the community and what small business does bring. I can think of some things that I would like to see happen. I don't know how exactly to get there. We're experiencing a situation, for instance, on Lincoln Road on Miami Beach. We have a 20-year lease that's coming due in about a year, So rents started, when we started there, rents were $6 a square foot. They're now about $125 a square foot. So what does someone do? What does a small business do? Do you want Lincoln Road to become, the land of just chains, which it's sort of becoming, kind of like the Third Street Promenade in L.A. or other places? How can, We think of parks, we think of schools, we think of, the other kind of museums, the other sorts of performing arts centers, the amenities in a town. And too often we completely overlook the kinds of spaces that Stacy was talking about, the retail spaces where, after all, we spend most of our time now in retail spaces. And we overlook that. We overlook that kind of environment. And I think that if local cities begin to sort of ask themselves, what is the value of X, Y, or Z business to a town, and what can we do to make sure that that business stays around? I think then at least the discussion is engaged. And something that Stacy and I were talking about a little bit before the event tonight is the idea of maybe there being some local land trusts that are developed, and those that land would be developed for local businesses in some way. You know, a perfect example is on Lincoln Road, where the South Florida Arts Center, you all remember the South Florida Arts Center, they were smart enough early on to buy buildings. So where in most gentrified areas the artists are gone, on Lincoln Road you still have, you know, artist studios. And it's because they were smart enough to understand through grants that they could buy some of these buildings and stick around there. So, you know, I can imagine what cities ought to do. I just don't know how to get there. And in places like Miami, you know, we're a little different than Austin, a little different than Bellingham. Miami, for, as we all know, a wonderful book was written by John Rothschild, which always epitomized what Miami and Florida was all about. The title of his book was Up for Grabs. And, you know, in Miami, this kind of argument is a more difficult argument to make, particularly with the powerful interests that are here. I'm not saying it's a conspiracy or anything. I'm saying that's just the way Miami has sort of developed. But what's really interesting is, to pick up on what Stacy said, I'm beginning to see a shift as well. I'm beginning to see people really understand there's kind of big box fatigue that's out there. It's like, oh no, not another vertical mall I have to walk into. People are beginning to realize that those small neighborhood great good places are the kinds of places that feel better when they walk into them.
Mitchell Kaplan owns Books and Books in South Florida. Stacy Mitchell is a senior researcher with the New Rules Project. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Water is running out in metropolitan Atlanta, and the drought of this most crucial natural resource is a huge problem. 5 million residents are struggling to come to terms with the drought's effects on their otherwise comfortable urban lifestyles. But a recent article from the Los Angeles Times points out that even though this problem is big and the impacts broadly felt, Metro Atlanta probably could have avoided this whole situation with just a little bit more foresight. Despite a population that nearly doubled between 1990 and today, very little was done to encourage the conservation of water in the area, a resource that is primarily drawn from a far-off reservoir in northern Georgia. A regional plan was drafted, however, but few metro counties chose to abide. And as projections foresee 2 million more people adding to the population by 2030, local governments are finally coming around to the idea that the status quo may not be the best policy. Meanwhile, with much talk of traffic congestion issues and road pricing seeping into the minds of public officials in the country's biggest cities, a transportation researcher is looking beyond the hype to more closely examine these ideas. In a recent piece published in the San Francisco Chronicle, researcher Gabriel Roth looks at how road pricing would only achieve its goals of reducing congestion if the private companies who operate the toll roads were able to reinvest revenues into building more roads as the market demands. This approach probably seems unconventional to the road pricing advocates who push it as a way to get more people out of their cars, but Roth argues that private companies would be much more efficient at building roads at the appropriate times than leaving that responsibility to the government. Roth argues this market-based private sector approach to building roads as they are demanded, not as they are affordable, will be able to sustainably achieve traffic congestion reduction in the long term. And finally, cities in California are taking steps to protect their industrial lands from being turned into housing. As cities nationwide experience a high demand for housing, industrial areas are rapidly being erased and reworked into loft-style housing and condominiums. Cities across the state are implementing strict regulations to make sure their industrial areas are preserved for their intended industrial uses. According to a recent article from the California Planning and Development Report, cities like San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, and now some cities in Southern California are drafting tight zoning regulations that keep factories from turning into housing. But some cities are hesitant to impose such strict zoning regulations, arguing that industrial uses are becoming obsolete in the modern age. But many of the Bay Area cities that have imposed the regulations are already seeing the benefits, as job rates grow and new industries move into what are becoming rare industrial sites. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk with Greg Robison about culinary tourism and Oregon Bounty. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Greg Robison is manager of Oregon Bounty, a job he says he was born to do. A fifth-generation Oregonian who grew up in central Oregon, food was always part of his recreation, whether hunting for wild asparagus, baking with his mom, or cooking family meals to avoid doing farm chores. In college, full menus from the makeshift kitchen in his dorm room became somewhat of a post-midnight legend, and he still cooks dinner in the evenings today. In addition to the Oregon Bounty Project, Greg is president of Robison Communications. Greg, when did food become a travel focus for Oregon?
Well, you know, I think for a long time food has been a part of what the Oregon culture is all about. But I would say really in the last 5 years or so is when Oregon as a state really grasped this concept of culinary tourism and said, you know, this is something that we can distinguish ourselves, you know, in the market tourism marketplace as a way to draw, you know, a higher end consumer here.
And where did culinary tourism originate? I take it, it's always been a part of travel, certainly, but it seems to have become much more formal recently.
Yeah, I think it probably started maybe in Rome, somewhere around several centuries ago. You know, it's been something that's been a part of destinations worldwide for a long time. If you go to Italy, you know, you go to Tuscany, you know, it's all about the food there. I would say here it really started, you know, back in the 90s, late 90s, mid to late 90s, when a lot of people, particularly in Oregon, started to really look at this resource that we had here and have here, which is an incredible bounty of products. In Portland, for instance, you know, you're an hour away from the coast where Dungeness crab and wild salmon are pulled in. You're less than an hour from the forests of the Mount Hood area where huckleberries, wild mushrooms, etc. And, you know, within 30 minutes of the core of Portland, you're in farm country. And so I think once people started to realize, A, that the palate was changing in the American diet, and people were demanding, you know, to know where their food came from and wanted it fresh, that's really when we started to see this change towards people coming to Portland specifically to eat here.
Who are food tourists?
Well, they tend to be someone who is probably a little bit more affluent. They are cognizant of what they're eating, what they're putting in their bodies. They are people who travel quite a bit. They tend to spend more when they go. They tend to take longer and spend more time in a location when they go there. I would say, you know, if you were to put them demographically, they're probably 30 plus. They're probably of a middle to upper income.
How do they organize their travel? I'm curious about this because, again, everyone goes to restaurants when they travel and eat out and sample the local cuisine. But what are the other pieces to this experience?
Well, particularly in Oregon, I think what you find is, for instance, with our growing wine industry. You know, Napa Valley has seen this for a long time. People tend to go there because of the wine, and that brings with it a lot of restaurants and other associated things. So particularly one of the most important aspects, I think, of the culinary tourism movement in Oregon was the wine industry coming of age in the 80s and 90s, so that you had a destination that brought people in. You know, they'd come into Portland, for instance, maybe spend a few nights, head out into the wine country, and all along there end up taking part in a lot of other things, restaurants, attractions, parks, you know, and all the wonderful scenery we have here.
We know that wine, as you say, Napa Valley is very familiar. We know how that's experienced by travelers. They travel to winery, taste the wine, see the grapes growing. Is there any comparable experience or collection of experiences for other types of food?
Well, in particular, it's interesting. We have an incredible growing craft brewing industry here in Oregon, the beer industry. second largest, I think, in the nation. And actually in Portland, there are more breweries within the city limits than any other city in the world. And so, believe it or not, we've got a lot of beer lovers coming to Oregon. And so that's another thing that's, that people are coalescing around. They come here for the great beers, and that's, you know, again, as it's tied to our agricultural background, we grow many of the hops that are used to make beer in the country here. So we're right where that stuff is grown. So a lot of this comes out of what's grown here and what's made here already, and we see industries popping up around that.
Do people tend to go out and see the hops growing? I mean, I'm trying to understand, is there a comparable experience to, say, seeing grapes grow? And it's not that you go into the vineyard and look carefully, perhaps. But, you know, there is this sense of even dining in the vineyard, and that's sort of a special way to experience wine and drink in the vineyards themselves out in the actual fields. Is there anything comparable to that in Oregon?
Well, there are a number of things. There are a lot of artisan producers here that have popped up that have exactly what you're talking about in Southern Oregon. Rogue Creamery, they're a world-class award-winning creamery. Small little creamery outside of Medford, a little town called Central Point. You walk in, you'd hardly know you were there, but once you're in there, you have this wonderful experience. And so things like that, the artisan producers, the cheeses, the products that are grown here as well. You know, yes, you've got a lot of opportunity to meet the producer. And I think that's really what kind of distinguishes Oregon, is it's all about the people here and the personalities and the ability to get up close and personal. You know, when you drop in on a winery here, unlike maybe in Napa Valley where you're in a tasting room with 40 other people, you know, on a tour that starts in 10 minutes, followed by another one with 40 people. You drop in on a tasting room here, and it's more than likely going to be the winemaker that's going to greet you. And that you'll find that pretty much throughout the spectrum of products here, be it chocolates or cheeses or beers or wines.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. Are there what are the foods that distinguish Oregon? You've mentioned some of them, the foods and drink that distinguish Oregon. When people, as you, what are the foods you lead with in culinary tourism?
I think more than anything, it's just the general notion of eating local. You know, I really believe that local is the new organic, and the ability to have the experience of dining on something that's grown here. Like I said, incredible seafood from the coast less than an hour away. We have incredible wild berries. There's a lot of foraging that goes on in the forests. Wild mushrooms, chanterelles. We're actually a truffle capital as well down in the Willamette Valley. A lot of organic beef and lamb and pork producers here as well. But it's really all about the seasonal products and the farmers market movement in particular that has grown up throughout the state. You can't go nearly a day in a city here in Portland without running into a farmer's market, and it's all about the seasonal products, whether that's tomatoes in August or asparagus in June.
You've mentioned a couple of things I want to pursue. First, the farmers markets. It seems that an interesting ecosystem is growing up around the food cluster. If you want to think about it more from an economic development standpoint, or the and the culinary tourism, which is sort of one piece of it that wouldn't exist, I guess, without the cluster. Describe the pieces, Greg, of that ecosystem.
Well, I think first it starts and it goes back to land use laws that allow us to have farms within close proximity to our urban centers. And you also have land that is affordable enough for the small to medium-sized farmer who is growing seasonal crops to be able to do it. You've got a city which is dedicated to providing the space to farmers through the vehicle of farmers markets to sell their products on a regular basis. And then you have a I think, a growing culture here that, again, is demanding to know not only where their food came from, but, you know, who grew it. And I think there's a lot of pride here in Oregon. And when visitors come here, they experience that and they can see that firsthand, you know, that there is the ability to know where that food came from.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Greg Robison. He is manager of Oregon Bounty. I want to go back to what you just said about the growing sophistication of the local market. I assume it would be difficult to have to have culinary tourism, in other words, bringing visitors to the city and to the state without a sophisticated local market. So. Is that a correct assumption?
Well, it's growing. I think there's still, you know, Oregon has a very unique personality. It's a very independent spirit that is can be both a blessing and a curse. And I think on the blessing side, it's people that really love what they do and love conveying that to other people. But at the same time, they have become sophisticated enough to know that the consumers are demanding it, and you know, they're delivering those products. And I think particularly in the restaurant scene, you're seeing this in Portland in particular, where you've got you know, what really now is a nationally recognized center for culinary. It's an amazing restaurant scene that's really unlike any other that you're going to find in the country. And I really you know, tie that to the fact that you know, as opposed to places like Las Vegas, which incredible, you know, culinary place. You've got some of the world's top chefs there, but you know, the food is all flown in on an airplane. Here in Portland, you've got a farmer showing up, you know, with his truck full of vegetables that morning, and that's what drives the menu. And I think that you're getting a lot of chefs coming in here from out of state, from the big places, that realize A, that they can afford to have a restaurant here, but B, they can have their pick of the best foods in the world whenever they need them.
And just to go back to my point, I'm assuming again, it's important to lead with a local market of consumers and then add on to that tourists. Now, that doesn't necessarily hold true in a place like Las Vegas, which is, you know, which is simply driven by tourism, or perhaps Orlando or other unusual places. But I would think in a place like Portland and in Oregon, you need a local market to drive the restaurant business, you know, the market that supports top chefs is first and foremost a local market rather than a tourism market, and then the tourism market becomes, you know, the nice add-on. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I think what you say, and the interesting point there is, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, as Oregon as a state has lost a lot of its major headquarters companies, you know, to mergers and acquisitions, what it has gained is a really phenomenal creative class here of people that are drawn to Oregon both because of the environment, but by being here, you know, they demand that kind of environment, that kind of culinary scene that then is something that a tourist wants to be a part of.
You were mentioning earlier the public policies such as land use that have encouraged the food industry, either by design or by accident. I'm wondering, what are the other ways in which the state encourages the food industry, and particularly culinary tourism?
Well, Travel Oregon, which is the Oregon Tourism Commission, has a program that I manage for them called Oregon Bounty. It's a fall tourism promotion, $500,000 promotion that we do each fall. Probably doesn't sound like a lot, but in Oregon, that is our largest tourism promotion that involves the entire state. And that program actually goes out and works with people in every corner of the state, in lodging, in restaurants, in wineries, in breweries, in harvest festivals, gathering all these people together and packaging this as something we can take out to the world and say, there's not a better time to come to Oregon than during the fall, during Oregon Bounty.
How do you handle the politics of naming the places that offer really interesting food worth experiencing
for visitors?
Well, if you could see me, you could see I don't have a lot of hair. So there is a little bit of a hair pulling there. You know, there are people who are definitely involved here, and that's who we tend to have gravitate towards us, are those restaurants, those lodging properties that understand the consumer that they're going after, and that they want to put in their effort and their time to make it something that's appealing. So, you know, in many cases, it's more getting people enthused and coalesced around a single thing, which is this idea called culinary tourism and Oregon Bounty, and getting them involved and making sure that, you know, they're delivering the product when we're delivering the consumers to their door.
Well, let me ask it a different way. If I were in my hometown of Memphis and I were talking barbecue, and there are some very famous and very good barbecue restaurants in Memphis, and then there are some very good ones that are a little bit off the beaten path. They're not members of the chamber or the Convention and Visitors Bureau. They don't pay their dues, but they deliver really good barbecue, and they're fun places to discover. Politically, sometimes those are hard for the tourism bureau to, you know, to promote, because they've got paying members in the same business as competitors who, you know, do pay their dues. So I'm curious, do you ever get into that sort of push and pull with those who pay and those who don't pay, or those who cooperate and those who don't, but you really think from a tourism standpoint, they're great experiences, so you bite the bullet and include them anyway?
Well, yeah, you do, and it takes a little bit of massaging. But I think in particular, once you get out of this realm of, you know, are they paying dues or not, as opposed to, you know, this is someone who's doing something world class that someone wants to come to, and the greater good that's going to be you know, enjoyed by everyone by including those people. I think, you know, we are now starting to realize that you know, we've got to play along if we're gonna build this thing in Oregon. It's got to be built on the best of Oregon, and you know, like I said, I think folks are starting to realize that.
Which other states or cities are getting into the culinary tourism business?
Well, I think there are others that have been doing it, you know, a long time. We mentioned Napa Valley. I think obviously they've been doing it a long time. Washington State, in particular, you know, they've got a fabulous wine industry up there, and they have a lot of the same sort of environment and geography type things. They have a lot of fresh food products. They're a coastal state like we are. Certainly, you know, the big boy in the United States, New York, has been doing certainly culinary stuff for a long time. But those would be our competitors. But, you know, our challenge and our goal is to really find out what it is that resonates, you know, with the consumer, so that when they think Oregon, they think, you know, this is in our head what it means. You mentioned, you know, the South and Memphis. Barbecue comes straight to mind. I think our goal in the next couple of years is to figure out what Oregon's barbecue is.
Is this a growth industry?
Absolutely a growth industry. We've seen you know, tourism grow. I think there was a survey that was done by the Travel Industry Association along with Travel Oregon that showed that, you know, 60% of leisure travelers in the next year would be taking some trip that that had to do with culinary tourism. You know, we have seen a growth certainly every year over the last 4 or 5 years in Oregon with tourism in general, but also with culinary tourism specifically. So, you know, it's something that that's not going to go away, and is going to, I think, grow for years.
Greg, can any city or state claim some sort of distinction in the area of food?
I think wherever you go, you've got it. You've got what's local, and it's a matter of whether you just do it because that's what you do, or you take the next step and really try to package it. You know, Iowa, you know, has its own food thing. You know, Minnesota, I can't tell you what it is, but you know, everyone's got something that makes it unique, and you know, it's a matter of how much they push that out there as a sort of a branding tool for who they are, both as a state but also as a culinary destination.
If a city were interested in pursuing such a strategy, where would they begin?
Well, I think it begins by bringing in all of the components that go into culinary tourism. You know, it's not just about the restaurants. It's making sure your lodging properties understand what it means, so that if they're selling a room in Alaska, they're not serving a New York product for their breakfast. They're finding a way to incorporate, you know, that unique experience and that that thing that really defines them, so that the experience for the consumer really becomes holistic and they start to see, gosh, I didn't know that Alaska was anything more than looking at glaciers. So that, you know, certainly defining who you are, getting producers to be a part of it, certainly getting the those that are in charge of the purse strings, if you will, to you know, in the marketing of the state, to be able to devote some of your messaging and some of your money to that particular to that message.
In addition to your work with the Oregon Tourism Commission, you've also worked with Brand Oregon. And we interviewed Dan Wyden some time ago about the work that his firm did, Wyden and Kennedy did, on Brand Oregon. And I'm wondering how that positioning is going now. What's the? Can you give me an update?
Well, it continues to evolve. The strategy that Dan and his firm came up with was a positioning called We Love Dreamers. It's all about finding the unique personalities that make up Oregon, and not selling necessarily geography as much as it is a feeling here. It continues to grow. It continues to be successful, and I think as we continue that message over the next couple of years, you'll see even more people starting to understand that Oregon has its own unique personality, unlike any other place.
It's interesting when you talk about you talked about the way in which the visits to Oregon's wine country differs from visits to Napa Valley, in that you can meet the producers. Was that a deliberate attempt to make good on the We Love Dreamers and to personalize the experience of visitors and others to Oregon, or is that just a happy coincidence?
Well, I think that's part of what I'd call the Oregon ethic, which is that you've got a lot of maverick people here who don't necessarily like to fit in, don't necessarily like to do the whole big Hollywood thing here. I think it's a pretty authentic experience that you find here. That you know, the Oregon winemaker, they're an artisan. They do handcrafted wines. They want to stay small enough to. You know, to really be able to work directly with their own product as well as the people that they're selling it to. And, you know, it's interesting, if you look at the total cases produced in Oregon, which I think is about 1.6 million in the 2006 vintage, you know, there are California wineries that probably produce nearly that much as all the Oregon wines produce. So it's a very, very different industry here, and one that I think that the consumers can see when they visit.
Greg, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Greg Robison is manager of Oregon Bounty. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. In the 1971 film Dirty Harry, Clint Eastwood explained, "You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky?" City View's commentator Walker Smith says he does.
Lately, my wife and I have been having an unbroken string of good luck. Knock on wood. Some little things, several big things, but things that never seemed to be quite this easy before. We got perfect seats after we got to the airport on our round-trip flight to a wedding in California, and both flights were early. We bought a computer that turned out to have a defective logic board. When we called to get it replaced, we learned that the new model had just been released, which we didn't know until then. So we wound up getting all of the latest features for the old price. We checked into a resort hotel at the cheapest room rate available, and were assigned by the computer to a corner room on the top floor. Things like this are just serendipity. There's nothing you can do to plan for them. You can't count on this sort of thing. You can barely believe it when it happens, but there's nothing you can do to make more of it. It's just plain luck. Still, luck is something we feel we can create for ourselves. It is a large part of our culture. State-run lotteries are a reliable way of funding social programs like schools because we continue to think that another dollar could change our luck. Slot machines, which generate completely random outcomes, totally unaffected by anything the player can do, are the most popular form of casino gambling in this country. Whatever else we may think, lotteries and slots are just plain luck, nothing more. Social psychologists have made careers of demonstrating the multiple ways in which human beings are bad at probabilistic thinking. All of our decision-making is driven by a mixture of logic and emotion, but when probabilities are involved, no amount of logic or emotion saves us from the repeated mistake of thinking that luck is something we can create for ourselves. But when I look around, I don't really see the need to create luck for ourselves. Luck is an unsolicited, unearned gift that life gives to all of us. The odds worked out for us to be here to begin with, and every day the odds work out for us to see another sunrise. Birds grace us with their flight, flowers brighten our spirits, and sunlight splashes our faces with warmth, and hey, don't forget, vitamin D. How lucky can you be? Life is a stroke of fortune with which we are all blessed. In our attempts to manipulate the odds, we overlook the fact that good luck is our constant companion. Where our probabilistic thinking fails us the most is not in believing that we can beat the long odds stacked against us, but in failing to realize that we have beaten some very long odds already, and that we beat them again and again every moment of our lives. We need only look to ourselves to know that our very presence on earth and all that we get just by being here makes lottery winners of us all. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.